from California Lutheran College, and there I teach a course called Curriculum and Research in Early Childhood Education. I haven't taught little ones for a long time. When I was at Augustana College about 8.5 years ago, I had lab school there and had 4-year-old. So many of my experiences that I'm going to tell you about are drawn from that experience. Children who are 4 years old can teach you a lot about awe and wonder, because through their eyes you see things for the first time, many things for the first time, and in new ways, in refreshing ways, as was illustrated by a young 4-year-old as we were hiking, taking a spring walk, we called it, through the campus. And we had fresh budded leaves on trees surrounding us, and one of the little boys said, "Oh, Mrs. Edmund, look, the trees are all smiling at us." And expressions like this came out time and again, which opened my eyes to see for the first time things that had been there all the time. I remember when our middle child was 1.5 years, we were living in Oklahoma, and we don't get a whole lot of snow in Oklahoma. This happened to be the first of the season. As I walked into her bedroom, she was standing up in her crib, pointing outside at those huge, fluffy flakes of snow that were just drifting down. And she said one word, powder. And ever since then, I think when I see one of these flaky, soft snowfalls, of that word powder, which opens my eyes again to the awe and wonder of the beauty of the snow. I think when we see things for the first time, when you came up to Holden today, I'm sure, or this week, or whenever, I'm sure you were filled with awe and wonder because you saw something for the very first time. And I hope that as you come back up here, each time you'll try to recall the first time you saw Holden so that you can renew that feeling of awe and wonder that I'm sure filled you at that time. There are so many ways in which a child can open your eyes to the excitement of the world. Just discovering the color green can be very exciting, providing the child discovers it for himself. We were painting with blue and yellow one day, and all of a sudden one of the children started screaming, "I found green, I discovered green." And the little girl next to him said, "He must be a professor. He discovered green." And that's the way it is with awe and wonder. We feel that we are the first to see it, that here it is. Does anybody else see it for the first time like we do? Or has anybody ever seen it before? Remember one mother called me one day and said that she just had to share this little story with me. Little Brian was down in the basement. She was up on second floor. And he started screaming, and she thought something was radically wrong. She ran down the stairs only to find him flat on his stomach watching an ant walk across the floor. And he said, "It does have 3 parts to its body. It does have 2 antennae. It's a genuine insect." And this is something she mentioned too. For the first time in her life, she could get excited about seeing a little ant crawling across the floor. And that's what we don't want to lose, is that feeling of excitement when we see things in God's world. In her book, The Sense of Wonder, Rachel Carson writes, "A child's world is fresh and new and beautiful, full of wonder and excitement. It is our misfortune that for the most of us, that clear-eyed vision, that true instinct for what is beautiful and awe-inspiring, is dimmed and even lost before we reach adulthood. My prayer for all children is that God's gift to each child in the world be a sense of wonder so indestructible that it would last throughout a lifetime. As an unfailing antidote against the boredom and disenchantments of later years, the sterile preoccupation with things that are artificial, the alienation from the sources of our strength. If a child is to keep alive his inborn sense of wonder, he needs the companionship of at least one adult who can share it, rediscovering with him the eager, sensitive, rediscovering with him the joy, excitement, and mystery of the world we live in. Parents often have a sense of inadequacy when confronted on the one hand with the eager, sensitive mind of a child, and on the other with a world of complex physical nature, inhabited by a life so various and unfamiliar that it seems hopeless to reduce it to order and knowledge. In a mood of self-defeat, they exclaim, "How can I possibly teach my child about nature? I don't even know one bird from another." I sincerely believe that for the child and for the parent seeking to guide him, it is not so half so important to know as to feel. In fact, if facts are the seeds that later produce knowledge and wisdom, then the emotions and the impressions of the senses are fertile soil in which the seeds must grow. The years of early childhood are the time to prepare the soil. Once the emotions have been aroused, a sense of the beautiful, the excitement of the new and the unknown, a feeling of sympathy, pity, admiration, or love, then we wish for knowledge about the object of our emotional response. Once found, it has lasting meaning. It is more important to pave the way for the child to want to know than put him on a diet of facts he is not ready to assimilate. If you are a person who feels he has little nature lore or at his disposal, there is still much you can do for your child. With him, wherever you are and whatever your resources, you can still look up at the sky, its dawn and twilight beauties, its moving clouds, and its stars by night. You can listen to the wind, whether it blows with majestic voice through a forest, or sings a many-voiced chorus around the eaves of your house or the corners of your apartment building. And as you listen, you can gain magical release for your thoughts. You can still feel the rain on your face and think of its journey, its many transmutations from sea to air to earth. Even if you live in a city, you can find some place, perhaps a park or a golf course, where you can observe the mysterious migrations of the birds and the changing seasons. And with your child, you can think about the mystery of a growing seed, even if it's only one planted in the pot of soil in the kitchen window. Exploring God's world with your child is largely a matter of becoming receptive to what lies around you. It is learning again to use your eyes, your ears, nostrils, and fingertips, opening up the disused channels of sensory impression. For most of us, knowledge of our world comes largely through sight. Yet, we look about with such unseeing eyes that we are partially blind. One way to open our eyes to unnoticed beauty is to ask yourself, "What if I'd never seen this before? What if I knew I would never see it again?" Don't forget the world of little things, seen all too seldom. Many children, perhaps because they themselves are small and closer to the ground than we, notice and delight in the small and the inconspicuous. With this beginning, it's easy to share with them the beauties we usually miss because we are in too much of a hurry seeing the whole and not its parts. Some of nature's most exquisite handiwork is on the miniature scale, as anyone knows who has looked through a magnifying glass at a snowflake. An investment of a few dollars in a good hand lens or magnifying glass will bring a new world into being. With your child, look at objects you take for granted as commonplace or uninteresting. A sprinkling of the grains of sand may appear as gleaming jewels of rose or crystal, or as glittering jet beads, or as a melange of Lilliputian rocks, spines of sea urchins, and bits of snail shells. Senses other than sight can prove avenues of joy and discovery, storing up for us memories that and impressions. Now back to Rachel Carson. Although Roger, my four-year-old nephew and I, out early in the morning, have enjoyed the sharp, clean smell of wood smoke coming from the cottage chimney. Down on the shore, we have savored the smell of low tide. That marvelous evocation combined many separate odors of the world of seaweeds and fishes and creatures of bizarre shape and habit, of tides rising and falling on their appointed schedule, of exposed mudflats and salt rime drying on the rocks. I hope Roger will later experience, as I do, the rush of remembered delight that comes with the first breath of that scent, drawn into one's nostrils as one returns to the sea after a long absence. For the sense of smell, almost more than any other, has the power to recall memories, and it is a pity that we use it so little. Hearing can be a source of even more exquisite pleasure, but it requires conscious cultivation. I've had people tell me that they'd never heard the song of a wood thrush, although I knew the bell-like phrases of this bird had been ringing in their backyards every spring. By suggesting an example, I believe children can be helped to hear the many voices about them. Take time to listen and talk about the voices of the earth and what they mean, the majestic voice of thunder, the winds, the sound of surf or flowing streams. I often took my four-year-olds on listening walks, and it was just amazing how they would pick up sounds that I hadn't heard. And the voices of living things. No child should grow up unaware of the dawn chorus of the birds in spring. We will never forget the experience of a specially planned early rising and going out in the pre-dawn darkness. The first voices are heard before daybreak. It is easy to pick these first solitary singers. Perhaps a few cardinals are uttering their clear rising whistles like someone calling a dog. Then the song of a white throat, pure and ethereal, with the dreamy quality of remembered joy. Off in some distant patch of woods, a whippoorwill continues this monotonous night chant, rhythmic and insistent. Sound that is felt, almost more than heard. Robins, thrushes, song sparrows, jays, vireos add their voices. The chorus picks up volume as more and more robins join in the contributing a fierce rhythm of their own that soon becomes dominant in the wild medley of voices. In that early chorus, one hears the throb of life itself. What is the value of preserving and strengthening this sense of awe and wonder, this recognition of something beyond the boundaries of human existence? Is the exploration of the natural world just a pleasant way to pass the golden hours of childhood, or is there something deeper? I'm sure there is something much deeper, something lasting and significant. Those who live as scientists or laymen among the beauties and mysteries of the earth are never alone, or do they ever tire of life. Whatever the anxieties or concerns of their personal lives, their thoughts can find paths that lead to inner contentment, and to renewed excitement in living. Those who contemplate the beauty of the earth find reserves of God's strength that that will endure as long as life lasts. There is symbolic as well as actual beauty in the migration of the birds, the ebb and flow of tide, the folded bud ready for spring.
There is something infinitely healing in the repeated refrains of God's natural world, the assurance that dawn comes after night and spring after winter. The lasting pleasures of contact with the natural world are not reserved for scientists, but are available to anyone who will place himself under the influence of God's creation of earth, sea, and sky, and their amazing life. How are we to explain all the miracles that crowd in upon the young child? The world unfolds about him in minute detail. Every step is an adventure into the new and the unfamiliar. Sunshine and shadows bring delight and amazement. Tiny insects that creep and crawl and fly are intensely interesting. Sand is fascinating to dig in, to pile up, to push around, to walk in, to pour water over, to spill through your fingers. Who made all these things? Where did they come from? Our answer is simply, in the beginning, God. Each day reveals new wonder, green grass soft under the bare feet, the gentle wind that rustles the leaves, the cold, wet splash of running water. Each day the same question comes, who can make all these things happen? Who? Our answer is as childlike as the words of the kindergarten hymn. Oh, who can make a flower? I'm sure I can't. Can you? Oh, who can make a flower? No one but God, 'tis true. The marvels of creation are beyond our comprehension. We can observe, we can follow patterns of growth. We can tie together lengthy explanations, but sooner or later we must face the question, who? Always we return to the sentence from Genesis, in the beginning God. It's easy to see God in the spectacular and exciting side of nature, yet so easy to ignore him in the ordinary provisions for living. What do we mean when we speak of the world about us? How long has it been since we have given up any thought of the so-called masks of God? We look at flowers casually without seeing the miracles of shape and color. We glance with amusement at a robin tugging desperately at a loose string hanging from a clothesline without seeing the miracle of nesting. We hurry along in the nighttime darkness, eyes to the ground, totally unaware of the heavens above. Too often we allow the magnificent world about us to slip by. How do we react in this fantastic age of penetrating the unknown in space, the unknown in energy, the unknown in medicine and engineering and physics and chemistry? Do we acknowledge the hand of God moving through these strange worlds? Is our concept of God's greatness growing along with our scientific explorations? Answers to these questions depend upon our adult thoughts of God. Either we take seriously the total creation and prepare ourselves to accept the whole of it as all his work which he has done in creation, or we must limp along believing in an important God shape to our own size. A small God is no God at all. This is my Father's world, deep, rich, varied. We are in it, we are part of it. We can revel in it, we can grow with it. Our God is the creator of the universe. His are its heights and depths, and nothing of it or in it shall separate us from him. Suppose we look now at the world through the eyes of a young child. What is most important in his world? The child himself, of course. He discovers the wonderful things he can do with his legs and his hands. He experiments with climbing and jumping. He learns to ride wagons, to skate, to pedal a tricycle. He learns to eat by himself, to dress without help, to pick up things and hold them and throw them. Somewhere along the line, we must help the child to know that he is made the way he is because God determined it. The gift of sight, the gift of hearing, and the gift of taste and touch and smell are all from God. The child is wonderfully made by a wonderful God. God's creation is the garment of God, an act of his self-expression serving his purpose, appropriate to his majesty and revealing his glory. But in all God's creation, the closest expression of God's nature is discernible in man. He is so made that he is capable of reflecting God's image itself. His self, then, is a very important part of the world about him. More than that, he gradually discovers the uniqueness of his own body. He does not walk like anyone else. He does not talk like anyone else. He doesn't look like anyone else. In many ways, the way the child relates to the world about him depends upon his physical body. This is true for adults as it is for children. Mental health reflects physical health, and both of these mirror our spiritual resources. Our whole outlook on life depends on the reply we make to Paul's question, "Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, which you have from God?" The world about us does not stand still. The young child soon discovers that change and growth are taking place all the time. He himself is growing so rapidly that he has difficulty keeping pace with himself. He watches his new kitten change almost overnight into a full-grown cat that wanders off with grown-up independence. He sees his soft, fuzzy chick change to a strange feathered creature that does not want to be held or petted. He watches his playful puppy grow along with him. Growth is a part of the everyday world. Perhaps he helps to plant a garden. The miracle of seeds coming to life is a thing to wonder about. Even the lowly earthworm is cause for excitement. The life cycle is close to the young child. He is curious about birth. He accepts the fact of death. He wonders about pain and hurt, about tragedy, about disappointments that come his way. Before we can be of much help to the young child, we need to think carefully about our own convictions regarding this phase of the world. What are we prepared to share with the child about the dynamics of growth and change in creation? When the child finds order and design in the world, he responds with a sense of trust. He feels secure in the pattern of his everyday world. It is possible for a child to live without acknowledging God. Our goal as Christian parents is to help our child sense that God is in creation and is close at all times. Whenever possible, we should take our children outdoors to look at the world firsthand. No matter where we live, there is always sky above. Crisp autumn air or soft spring breezes can tell many secrets to young children. Even on the city sidewalks, insects thrive. In the center of town, bird life flourishes. We need to plan so that our children can observe, wonder, and give thanks to God for the things of creation that they find. I discovered a little story called The Night the Stars Fell, and it's from a book that was edited by Arthur Gordon called A Touch of Wonder. And here's the way it goes. One summer night in a seaside cottage, a small boy felt himself lifted from bed. Dazed with sleep, he heard his mother murmur about the lateness of the hour, heard his father laugh. Then he was borne in his father's arms with the swiftness of a dream down the porch steps out onto the beach. Overhead, the sky blazed with stars. "Watch," his father said, and incredibly, as he spoke, one of the stars moved. In a streak of golden fire, it flashed across the astonished heavens, and before the wonder of this could fade, another star leaped from its place, and then another, plunging toward the restless sea. "What is it?" the child whispered. "Shooting stars," his father said. "They come every year on certain nights in August. I thought you'd like to see the show." That was all. Just an unexpected glimpse of something haunting and mysterious and beautiful. But back in bed, the child stared for a long time into the dark, wrapped with knowledge that all around the quiet house, the night was full of the silent music of falling stars. Decades have passed, but I remember that night still, because I was the fortunate 7-year-old whose father believed that a new experience was more important for a small boy than an unbroken night's sleep. No doubt in my childhood, I had the usual quota of playthings, but these are forgotten now. What I remember is the night that the stars fell, the day we rode in a caboose, the time we tried to skin the alligator, the telegraph we made that really worked. I remember the trophy table in the hall where the children were encouraged to exhibit things we had found. Snake skins, seashells, flowers, arrowheads, anything unusual or beautiful. I remember the books left by my bed that pushed back my horizons and sometimes actually changed my life. Once my father gave me Zuleika Dobson, Max Beerbohm's classic story of undergraduate life in Oxford. I liked it, and I told him so. "Why don't you think about going there yourself?" he said casually. A few years later, with luck and a scholarship, I did. My father had, to a marvelous degree, the gift of opening doors for his children, of leading them into areas of splendid newness. This subtle art of adding dimensions to a child's world doesn't necessarily require a great deal of time. It simply involves doing things more often with our children instead of for them or to them. One woman I know keeps what she calls a why not notebook, and in it she scribbles all sorts of offbeat and fascinating proposals. Why not take the kids to the police headquarters and get them fingerprinted? Why not visit a farm and attempt to milk a cow? Why not arrange a ride on a tugboat? Why not follow a river dredge and hunt for fossilized shark's teeth? And so they do. One day I asked her where she got her idea. "Oh," she said, "I don't know. But when I was a child, I had this wonderful old ne'er-do-well uncle who used to open doors for her, just as she is opening them now for her own children. Aside from our father, we had a remarkable aunt who was a genius at suggesting spur-of-the-moment plots to blow away the dust of our daily drudgeries. Once, I remember, she arranged for us to ride a pony that was a bit skittish. After being thrown 3 times, my brother protested tearfully that riding this particular animal was too difficult. If it were too easy, our aunt said serenely, it wouldn't be any fun. Just a casual phrase, but it sticks in my memory. The easiest door to open for a child usually is one that leads to something you love yourself. All good teachers know this, and all good teachers know the ultimate reward, the marvelous moment when the spark you are breathing on bursts into a flame and henceforth will burn brightly on its own. At a United States Golf Association tournament a few years ago, a pigtailed 10-year-old played creditably in the juniors' girls' championship. "How long have you been interested in golf?" someone asked her. "Oh, I got it for my 9th birthday, she said. "You mean your father gave you a set of clubs?" "No," she said patiently. "He gave me golf." I was reminded as I read that 2 years ago, our little 7-year-old grandson was with us here at Holden, and Rudy gave him fishing. This year he's going to give him rocks. Now, the possessor of a wonderful realm had wanted his child to share the magic kingdom. No doubt it took some time and effort, some patience, some mystical transference of enthusiasm. But what a reward for both of them. And it might just as well have been music or astronomy or chemistry or collecting butterflies. any world at all. Children are naturally inquisitive and love to try new things, but they can't find these things by themselves. Someone must offer them the choices. Years ago, when the Quiz Kids were astonishing American radio audiences with their brilliance, a writer set out to discover that what common denominators there were in their backgrounds. He found that some were from poor families, some from rich, some had been to superior schools, and some had not. But in every case investigated, there was one parent, sometimes two, who shared enthusiasms with the child, who watched for areas of interest, who gave encouragement and praise for achievement, who made a game of searching out the answers to questions, who went out of his way to supply the tools of learning. No doubt the capacity for outstanding performance was already there, but it took the love and interest and companionship of a parent to bring it out. Recently, a neighbor of ours took his two children to the mountains for a vacation. The very first morning, the children woke him at daybreak, clamoring to go exploring. Stifling an impulse to send them back to bed, he struggled into his clothes and took them for a walk. At the edge of the pond, they stopped to rest, and while they were sitting there quietly, a doe and her fawn came down to drink. I wonder how many of you have had that experience with your children here at Holden. There's a salt lick behind Chalet 1, and in early morning or in the evening, you'll often find the deer feeding on the salt lick. I watched my youngsters' faces as they watched the doe and her fawn. And suddenly, it was as if I were seeing and feeling everything for the first time. The hush of the woods, the mist over the water, the grace and the gentleness of those lovely creatures, the kinship of all living things. It only lasted a few seconds, but the thought came to me that happiness isn't something that you have to strive and struggle for. It's simply an awareness of beauty and harmony of existence. And I said to myself, remember this moment. Put it away carefully in your mind, because you may need to draw strength and comfort from it someday. Giving his children a new experience, that man also had opened a door for himself. I have a friend, a psychiatrist, who says that basically there are two types of human beings: those who think of life as a privilege and those who think of it as a problem. The first type is enthusiastic, energetic, resistant to shock, responsive to challenge. The other type is suspicious, hesitant, withholding, self-centered. To the first group, life is hopeful, exciting. To the second, it's a potential ambush. And he adds, tell me what sort of a childhood you had, and I can tell you which type you are likely to be. The real purpose, then, of trying to open doors for children is not to divert them or amuse them. It is to build eager, outgoing attitudes toward the demanding and complicated business of living. This surely is the most valuable legacy we can pass on to the next generation. Not money, not houses or heirlooms, but a capacity for wonder and gratitude, a sense of aliveness and joy. Why don't we work harder at it? Probably because, as Thoreau said, our lives are frittered away in detail because there are times when we don't have the awareness or the selflessness or the energy. And yet, for those of us who care what becomes of our children, the challenge is always there. None of us meets it fully, but the opportunities come again and again. Many years have passed since that night in my life when the stars fell, but the earth still turns, the sun still sets, night still sweeps over the changeless sea, and next year when August comes with its shooting stars, my son will be 7. And through his son's eyes, he'll relive that first night, I'm sure, of the night when he himself saw the shooting stars for the first time. Now, simple experiments enable the child to participate in the mechanics of understanding what makes the world go round. They cause him to ask why, what happened, how come? So an experiment takes its place as an important way for him to learn. You can carry out experiments under the simplest of circumstances. You can make a circle with water, fan it dry. What happens? Where did the water go? Cut an apple, a pumpkin. Where are the seeds? What do you see? Plant a bean on a wet blotter. Roll grass seed over damp, absorbent cotton. What have you started? Hang a sheet several feet in front of a sunny window. Can you make a shadow? Why? What happens? Blow bubbles. Where do the bubbles go? Where do the colors come from? These kinds of activities arouse a child's curiosity. They let him use his powers of observation, require thought, and move him to acknowledge the wonder of God. The important thing is to provide an outlet for the child's need to relate all things to God. Wonder, awe, reverence, and stewardship of the creation are fostered by the attitude of the adults around the child. They take time. They suit the individual. God speaks to the child as well as to the adult. We set the stage. We point the way. We wait for the child and God to meet. Now, I'd like very much for you people to share with us experiences that you can remember as a child, which experiences of awe and wonder, or for perhaps with your children, maybe something that happened here at Holden Village since you got here. I'm sure you have those experiences, and it would enrich all of us if you would tell us about them. We took a group of people up to 10 Mile Creek Falls today. They had never seen it before. But just by doing it, we saw 10 Mile Creek Falls for the first time again through their eyes. Right.
You become so used to seeing the same things that you've forgotten the first time.
That's right. And I think that it would help all of us if we tried to remember the first time that we saw things in nature for the very first time, if we could recapture those emotions as we travel to different national parks, for instance. Can we remember the first time we saw the Tetons? Well, we can re-experience awe and wonder just in our memory. Of, for instance, we see something in a paper about a country that we have visited, a foreign country, and all of a sudden you see that country in your mind's eye, in memory.
Walking downtown, and she looked up, saw a bird up in the tree, and she said, "Don't fall, bird."
Oh, that's beautiful.
And even when you're older, you suddenly see things again. Like when the doctor told me I might not have too long to live, all of a sudden you see the sun come up, and the trees are green, and the birds have beautiful songs, and when you find out that that's not true, it's still beautiful. Right. And you think you might lose it, then all of a sudden you've got it the rest of your life.
Right.
First time I went above the tree line, it really filled me with awe and realized how small a creature I really was, because I had never lived on the flats of Illinois and all the people around, I never knew what it was like to be above the tree line.
Yeah. Did you hear the birds singing below you?
I guess I was so awed that I couldn't believe who I was.
I remember when I got the Cloudy Pass the first time. I'll never forget it. The most magnificent feeling. I guess the very fact that I got there was filled me with awe and wonder, let alone the gorgeous view that I experienced after I got to that spot.
Even to see a mountain for the first time when you lived
right.
in the Flatlands always.
Yes.
I remember now, and I hadn't thought of it for a long time, but I remember how I felt.
I was an adult when I saw a mountain for the first time.
On the other hand, after you've been away from the beautiful Midwest for a long time, you go back and see that beautiful bread box of the United States, there's nothing more beautiful than those cornfields.
The lush green grass that doesn't have to be watered.
You're right. Yes, we experienced that. We've lived in California 10.5 years and went back to, and drove back to the Mississippi Valley again and back. And we just exclaimed all the way, how beautiful, you know, how beautiful. It was just like although we were born there and raised there, it was again like we were seeing those cornfields and those beautiful expanses of flatlands for the first time.
I had something unusual happen last fall. We were up at Lake Superior along the North Shore and went hiking. And it was end of October, and the leaves had all fallen off the trees. It was a beautiful day. It was like 70, 80 degrees in Minnesota, which is unheard of usually at that time of the year. And we went hiking, and we went to the top of this, what we call a mountain in Minnesota. And there were no birds. And it was just so weird. They had all flown south.
Oh, yes.
And, or most of them. And, you know, you imagine when you're walking in the woods that you're going to hear those sounds. And there wasn't any. It was just the wind blowing. And that was really different. You know, because I had always heard birds, so.
It must have been the feeling I had when I walked into a class of autistic children as a volunteer a few years ago. A room full of children and none of them could speak. It must have been like no songs from the birds. That's the way I felt about the children. No beautiful sounds.
I suppose the first one that happened to me, when I was a child, I was out skating on a little pond, you know, we had beside the crib. I grew up on a farm in Illinois, too. The Northern Light started.
You feel
Norwegian
so...
Norwegian immigrants, Northern Lights were nothing to them.
It's almost like experiencing God for the first time. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for sharing.
I have the last word.
Okay.
The state of my mind that I learned from a person in one of our state institutions at the time. I had taken a psychology class to visit this state institution, and there was a tree where the birds were coming in and out, and down below stood a woman holding a Bible all tied up with string. And I said something to her, "Are you feeding the birds?" And she said, "Yes, I get bread when I eat, and then I save it for them." And she said, "I remember my German grandmother who told me that no matter how high anyone ever gets, they always have to come down. And therefore, the birds have to come down to eat." I thought, what a beautiful picture to learn from someone in a state of
peace. Yes, yes, indeed.
I've thought of it so many, many times. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, Doris.
Oh.